Okay, so first, you gotta understand that it wasn't just me. In fifth grade at Fancher Elementary in Mount Pleasant, Michigan, we all loved Mr. Hansen, right? He wasn't just a music teacher. He directed the city orchestra. Mr. Hansen spoke to us about music like we were adults and made us feel thrown into the pieces. Here is where the tension is. Feel the tension, feel it! It's tight, stretched tight like a rubber band. Wait! There's the break, the release. Isn't it wonderful? His joy became our joy. But Mr. Hansen had favorites. And for a young nerd, there could be no higher honor. These favorites were the first in the orchestra, the first violin, the first cello, the first flute. I went to the orchestra sign-up with high hopes. Mr. Hansen began by apologizing. We don't have many open spots. This is a highly select group. I sat crestfallen. But if there's someone who would maybe like to play the cello, I leapt to my feet, raised my hand, cello, yeah, cello. I was gonna be the first cello, and it was gonna be awesome. Mr. Hansen examined me. Do you have a cello? No. Can you afford to purchase a cello? No way. Then he looked at me intently. If I were to loan you one of our cellos, would you care for it the way a new mother swaddles her freshly born baby? Yes. Say again? Yes, I'll take care of the cello like it was a baby. We'll see. He pointed me toward a large nylon case, and inside, there it was, my cello. It smelled like cello. And later that night, I started speaking like him. Mother! Mother, I shall practice my cello! And at the end of the first 2 weeks, Mr. Hansen had us all play sheet music to determine rankings. I played. And when I saw the rankings posted to the door, I was crushed. Mr. Hansen placed me fifth. Fifth! It was an insult of the highest order. And just as I started to curl into a fetal position, I spied another note. It said that every Monday, you could challenge anyone to move up the rankings a spot. Murder flooded my eyes. I would challenge for the seat until I earned my rightful place amongst the first. So I did. I challenged and bumped fourth cello that very day. And I practiced, and I practiced. I wanted Mr. Hansen to notice, to believe, to inspire, and be inspired by my love of music. I challenged for the third seat, and I won. And then one day, I saw Mr. Hansen taking all the first out for ice cream. I practically screamed in frustration. Look at me! I like music. I like ice cream. Look at me. I challenged the second that next Monday. Performed with even, strong, delicate strokes of my horsehair bow against the strings of the cello. I looked at the first. She was trembling in her sneakers, knowing she was next. Mr. Hansen winked at me before declaring me the winner. One more challenge. I practiced until the tips of my fingers bled from pressing down the strings, but I would not tire. Then I heard this loud snap. My heart leapt into my throat. I'm scared to look down. I look down and I see the strings hanging loose. From my cello, the piece of wood that holds the strings up the bridge had fallen off. This instrument cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and Mr. Hansen had given it to me, and I had broken it. I tasted vomit in my mouth. I walked out of my room and told my mother. She looked at the mess like she had something in her mouth as well. Mama, maybe we can fix it. Maybe, she said. We gotta figure a way to get that bridge to stick back on there. Well, I got some Elmer's glue. All right. We painted some of the glue on the cello. We pried the bridge into place. We squirted some extra glue around the bridge just in case. I stood back. It looked pretty good. Thanks, Mom. The next morning at orchestra rehearsal, we all start to play. Mr. Hansen makes a scrunched up face. What? Just the strings, please. He sniffs about like a hound dog. We all play. Now, cellos. Cellos, just the cellos. We play. He looked at me. You play. I played. Then this man that I admired more than any other looked at my instrument. What have you done? Well, my mama, is this paste stuck to my cello paste?
No, that's not paste. It's your little Elmer's glue. It's some glue. Everyone, come here at once.
The orchestra gathered round me and my cello.
I want everyone to know and to understand that these precision instruments are held in place by pressure, by tension, and not by paste.
We removed the bridge from the first cello, showed it to everyone, then simply shoved it back into place.
Do you understand?
The first cello, she smirked at me. Paste. Solvent was later procured. Screaming commenced. Paste removed. More screaming. Finally, my cello was returned. When I showed up for the next rehearsal, Mr. Hansen whispered simply, sixth. I gazed down at the first chair as if it were protected by iron bars. I looked at Mr. Hansen. I had so much love to give. But I knew then I would never play the right notes.
Heartbreaker, I cannot breathe.
Today on Snap Judgment. From PRX and NPR, Unrequited.
So over.
Amazing stories about love given when you feel no love in return. My name is Glenn Washington. Get ready, because this is Snap Judgment. Today on Snap, we spare no expense. Come with us now to the island of Borneo, where Augustine Fuentes, he studies the elusive green leaf monkey. And Augustine lived in the jungle, stayed at an orangutan sanctuary where orangutans that had been trafficked as pets and circus animals were taken and reintroduced into the wild.
Orangutans show up at these rehabilitation centers when police confiscate them. Sometimes you get ones that have been highly trained, so they come wearing clothes and used to living an almost human life. People teach them to pour drinks, wait tables, ride bicycles, put makeup on them, have them smoke cigarettes and drink alcohol, and people think that's funny. And that's the really scary thing, is people don't realize how dangerous some of these apes can be. I have to explain to people all the time that all the other primates are not teddy bears. They're wild animals. When we arrived there, we were warned to stay away from the big male who was living outside of camp but would come in when they fed every day. And that male would come in out of the jungle for the feeding, and the feeding would be this giant wooden cart filled with fruits. The male would just walk right up to the cart. The young man holding the cart would move away, and that big orangutan male would shove an entire pineapple in his mouth, chew it, and then take another one. It was a little bit dicey. My fear of the orangutans had two reasons behind it. The first one is they're amazingly strong. Even a small orangutan is stronger than I am. The second thing is that these ex-captives, these ones who had ventured into their human world and came back to a sort of mixture of human and their own world, they're less predictable. So I gave him a wide berth. I was chasing the extremely elusive maroon leaf monkey. It's a reddish-furred leaf monkey that runs around in the top of the trees. After a few weeks at the camp, I was a bit frustrated because I'd been going out every day and hadn't been able to find the monkeys. I found plenty of other animals, but no monkeys. So today I was determined. I was going to go out and find those monkeys. I spent pretty much all day out in the jungle. It's late afternoon. I figure time to get back to camp. I don't want to get stuck out at night. I have a headlamp in case I need it, but being out by yourself at night in the jungle is not a good idea. I turn around and start going back, and I immediately realize I'm not on a trail anymore. And I'm noticing a change in the jungle. The sounds start to change, the light starts to change, the jungle starts to wake up in some ways at night. I pulled out my compass and took a sort of general reading. I'm lost. I figured that pretty quickly. I'm a little nervous and just sort of wandering through in the direction I'm hoping is the right direction. I come across an opening. I thought, oh, well, maybe this is a path. And in that opening, in the sort of fading rays of light, I see this unbelievable shimmering on the ground. And I look down and it's blue. It's sort of this metallic blue shimmering. I didn't know what it was, so I moved out into it. And then, out of nowhere, it rises off the ground and flows up right all around me. And it turns out it was hundreds of metallic blue butterflies, and it was one of the most beautiful experiences in my entire life. Then I started to hear noises around me, and it got a little less great. I became completely disoriented. I felt defenseless. It's a different kind of world. It's getting darker, and I'm starting to get extremely concerned. I start to realize that I might have to spend the night out in the forest. I had a little bit of water. I have a knife on me. Moving along in this area, I hear a rustle. But it's not on the ground, it's not in front of me, it's not behind me. It could be anything. I hear it again, and I can tell it's up in the trees. So I have a headlamp on. I look up, and I hear the rustle. I'm not sure what it is. And then I catch a glimpse of red. Red fur. It's an orangutan. And I was in trouble. She looks down at me, I look up at her, and she just sort of walks down the tree, onto the ground, approaches me, and sticks her hand out. I didn't hesitate. For some reason, it was so inviting, and the moment of communication between us was so powerful that I didn't think about it. I just put my hand in hers. She wrapped her fingers around mine, and they were muscular, and you could feel the bones and the tensile strength in them. But the skin was really soft, which surprised me for a critter who's climbing up and down trees all day. And she was able to hold my hand very, almost tenderly. It's very, very soft, even though I knew she could probably break the bones in my hand if she wanted just by curling her fingers. She grasps it tenderly, and she immediately turns and starts walking. And I was absolutely shocked at first, and then almost immediately I realized what was going on. She was heading into camp, and she was taking me with her. The moment was so magical, but it was so different from anything. I don't think I had any context in which to place it. And I've spent the last 15 years telling people not to touch the monkey. Here it is, my story about me, holding hands with orangutan. So after I got back to camp and had this incredible experience, I was there for another 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, and I saw the orangutan two, maybe three times on the edge of the camp, maybe eating. I always sort of tried to position myself so we could make eye contact or I'd be somewhere near her. To be honest, I sort of wanted her to recognize me, to acknowledge this incredible interaction we'd had, but it was to no avail. She didn't really even take much notice of me after that. You feel at first a little slighted. We didn't have the connection that I thought we did. This is something that I'm going to think about for the rest of my life. Did she want to help me? I think she definitely sensed that I was scared and in need. But she had her life, I had mine. She had been there in the moment, I was there in the moment, and, both of us went our separate ways.
Big thanks to Professor Fuentes for sharing that story with Snap. And remember, don't touch the monkey. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Pat Macedi Miller. Now, when we return, Snap Judgment pals around with the clan and we hang out with rock stars backstage. Snap Judgment, the unrequited episode continues. Stay tuned. Yeah. Welcome back to Snap, the unrequited episode, where we give love, hoping for a little bit in return. For our next story, we sent Snap's own Nick Vanderkolk out to the wilds of Maryland to meet Daryl Davis, where he told us his story. And fair warning, this piece does use a word that is not appropriate for polite company. Actually, the word is not appropriate for any company whatsoever.
In 1983, country music had made a resurgence in this country. So I joined a country band. I was the only black guy in the band, and consequently, usually the only black guy in many of the places where we played. Well, there was this truck stop in a place called Frederick, Maryland. Truck stop had a motel. In the bottom of the motel was this lounge called the Silver Dollar Lounge. And it was basically an all-white lounge. Black people did not go in there. First time I played there, I came off the bandstand after the first set, and I was walking across the dance floor to sit with some of my bandmates. And this white gentleman, probably in his mid to late 40s, gets up from his table and walks across the bandstand from behind, puts his arm around my shoulder. And I stopped and turned around and looked to see who was touching me. And he says, "I really like your all's music. You know, this is the first time I ever heard a black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis." I had no idea where this guy was coming from. And I naively and innocently asked him, "Where did you think Jerry Lee Lewis learned how to play?" And he says, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Well, Jerry Lee learned how to play that style from black, blues, and boogie-woogie piano players. That's where rockabilly and rock and roll came from." "Oh, no. Jerry Lee invented that. I never heard no black man play like that until you." I even told the guy, "I know Jerry Lee Lewis personally. He's a good friend of mine. I've known him since I was 13 years old. He's told me himself where he learned how to play." Well, the guy didn't buy it. But he was fascinated with me, and he wanted to buy me a drink. Now, I don't drink, but I agreed to go back to his table and have a cranberry juice. He says, "You know, this is the first time I ever sat down and had a drink with a black man." And I'm thinking, you know, this guy is really having a night of firsts here. I asked him, I said, why? And he didn't answer me. He stared at the tabletop. And his buddy elbowed him in the ribs and said, tell him. Now he says, I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan. I started laughing. I figure, okay, this guy thinks I'm jerking him around about Jerry Lee Lewis, so he's gonna jerk me around about the Klan. While I'm laughing, he goes inside his pocket, pulls out his wallet, and hands me his Klan card. His looked like it had a Klansman on horseback, and then on the other side was this red circle with a white cross and a red blood drop in the center, which is the Ku Klux Klan insignia. It's called a Myoke, or a blood drop emblem. I stopped laughing, because I recognize that stuff. You know, this is for real. So now I'm wondering, what the hell am I doing sitting at a table with a Klansman? And I gave him back his card, and we talked about some other things. The guy gave me his phone number. He wanted me to call him anytime I was to come back to this bar with this band, because he wanted to bring his buddies, right? His Klan buddies, to see this black guy play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. We were on a rotation at that club every 6 weeks, you know, with other bands. So I called the guy like on a Wednesday or a Thursday and said, hey man, I'm gonna be at the Silver Dollar, come on out. He'd come and he'd bring his Klansmen and Klanswomen friends, and they'd gather around and watch me play. They'd get out there on the dance floor and dance. There were some who didn't want to meet me, you know, they were kind of standoffish, just like, you know, watch me from afar, but I knew it was them. Others, you know, were curious and wanted to, you know, I mean, they shook my hand and all that kind of stuff. Well, anyway, this went on about every 6 weeks until the end of 83, at which time I quit the band. Get that right, Freudian slip there. Okay. I quit the band and I went back to playing rock and roll and blues and, you know, whatever genre was popular in 84. And so, you know, I lost contact with the guy. Music is my profession, but learning more about racism on all sides of the tracks was my obsession. I began collecting everything I could get my hands on that dealt with white supremacy, black supremacy, anti-Semitism, the Nazis in Germany, the neo-Nazis over here, the Ku Klux Klan, things like that. It was incomprehensible to me that someone who had never seen me before, someone who knew absolutely nothing about me, would want to inflict pain upon me for no other reason than the color of my skin. They didn't know anything about me. I hadn't done anything. And the question that I had back then was, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? That question stayed with me. Eight years later, I decided I want an answer to my question. So, I'm gonna interview all these races. I need to write a book. So I chose the Klan, because man, I could have chose, you know, the Nazis, but I had made some kind of relationship with this Klansman. So I'm gonna track down that Klansman from the Silver Dollar Lounge. He had moved. He did not have a phone, but he had an address. So unannounced, I went by his apartment one evening. Okay, I knock on the door, right, in this hallway, and he opens the door. He says, Daryl, what are you doing here? And he steps out into the hallway and looks up and down the hallway to see if I brought anybody with me, right? Well, when he stepped out of his apartment, I stepped in. So he turns around, he comes back in. He goes, what's going on, man? Are you still playing? What's going on? I said, yeah, I'm still playing, man. But listen, I need to talk to you about the Klan. I said, you remember, right? He goes, well, I was. He said he'd quit, and he went into this long story. Well, I said, where's all your Klan stuff? And he says, well, they came and got it. Apparently, he had not paid off his robe and hood, and they came and repoed it. And I said, do you know Roger Kelly? Yeah, I know Roger. Roger was my Grand Dragon. In their terminology, they called the state leader the Grand Dragon. I asked him to hook me up with the Grand Dragon. And he said, no, he couldn't do that. And I said, but wait a minute, you know, you're out of the Klan now. He goes, it doesn't matter, Daryl. Well, I begged and pleaded with him to give me Mr. Kelly's information. Well, 20 minutes later, he finally consented to giving it to me on the condition that I not reveal to Mr. Kelly where I got his home address and his home phone number. He warned me. He said, Daryl, do not go to Roger Kelly's house. Roger Kelly will kill you. I called my secretary who books my band. Mary worked here out of my house. I said, here, give Roger Kelly a call and tell him you're working for somebody who's writing a book on the Klan. Would he consent to sitting down and being interviewed? Do not tell Mr. Kelly that I'm black, unless he asks. If he asks, don't lie to him. But don't allude to it. Don't give him any reason to ask. And so I had her call, and he agreed. We set up the meeting for the motel right above the Silver Dollar Lounge, and at 5:15 on a Sunday afternoon, Mary and I got there early. I gave Mary some money, and I sent her down the hall to get some soda and put it in the ice bucket so I would be able to offer my guest a beverage. I had no idea what this man was going to do when he saw me. Was he going to freak and attack me because I'm black? Was he going to say, I'm not talking to you, and turn around and leave? Or was he going to come in and be interviewed like he had agreed to do? I was not armed. My secretary was not armed. Right on time, knock, knock, knock on the door. Mary hops up, runs around the corner, and opens the door. In walks the Grand Nighthawk. Nighthawk in Klan terminology means bodyguard. He's wearing military camouflage fatigues, the Ku Klux Klan insignia, and on his right hip, he had a gun. Mr. Kelly is walking directly behind this guy in a dark blue suit. The Nighthawk turns the corner, and upon seeing me, he freezes instantly. Mr. Kelly bumped into his back, and they stumbled around, you know, trying to regain their balance, looking all over the room like, something's wrong here. I get up and I walk over. I said, hi, Mr. Kelly. Put my hand out. My name is Daryl Davis. He shook my hand. So far, so good. I said, come on in, come on in. The Nighthawk shook my hand. Mr. Kelly sat down. I'm like, yes, you know, he's going to do it. And the Nighthawk stood at attention to his right. Right before I could sit down, Mr. Kelly says to me, Mr. Davis, do you have any form of identification? And I said, yes. And I reached into my wallet and pulled out my driver's license and gave it to him. And he says, oh, you live on Flack Street in Silver Spring. Well, now, that had me a little concerned. Why is this man reciting my street address? He doesn't need to know that. I don't need him coming here burning a cross on my lawn. I didn't want to let him know that he had, you know, slightly unnerved me or rattled me. But I want to let him know that, you know, don't screw around. So I said, yes, Mr. Kelly, that is where I live. And you live at, and I named his house number and his street. We started doing the interview. And everything, you know, was going along smooth. I mean, every now and then somebody might pound the table with their fists to make a point. Every time Mr. Kelly would say, well, Mr. Davis, the Bible says, you know, I'd reach down into my bag and pull out the Bible and hand it to him to show me where it said blacks and whites had to be separate. Or if my cassette ran out of tape, I'd reach down into the bag and pull out my cassette and refresh the recorder. Every time I reached down, the Nighthawk would reach up to his gun. A little over an hour into this interview, there was a strange noise, kind of like... I immediately jumped up out of my chair and slammed my hands on the table. My mind was racing, like, you know, 90 miles an hour, trying to think, what did I just say? What did I just do to cause him to go off and make some weird noise? And all I could hear in the back of my head was that former Klansman saying, Daryl, do not fool with Roger Kelly. Roger Kelly will kill you. All right? So I didn't want to die that day, and I'm getting ready to come across that table, grab the Nighthawk and Mr. Kelly, and slam them both down to the ground and disarm the Nighthawk. My eyes locked with Roger Kelly's eyes. My eyes were clearly saying, what did you just do? and I could read his eyes. What did you just do? And the Nighthawk had his hand on his gun, looking back and forth between both of us, like, what did either one of you all just do? Mary, she was over here sitting on top of the dresser. She realized what happened. And then it made that same noise again. Some of the ice cubes in the ice container melted, an ice bucket melted, and the cans of soda shifted. We all began laughing at how ignorant we were. We continued with the interview, and there were no more problems. At the end, I shook their hands and thanked them for their time, and Mr. Kelly gave me one of his clam cards. And he said, keep in touch. And I was thinking to myself, I didn't say it, but I was thinking to myself, what? You know, I didn't come here to make friends with the clam. I came here to find out, you know, how can you hate me when you don't know me? And he didn't like me. I mean, he told me as much. On the way back home, I said to Mary in my car, I said, you know, I rather like Roger Kelly. I like him as a person. I do not like what Roger Kelly stands for. But I found that we had more in common than we did in contrast. Basically, what we had in contrast was how we each felt about race. Other than that, we agreed on a lot of things in common. We need to get drugs off the street. We need better education for kids. Things like that, you know, we can agree upon. So whenever I had a gig up in his county, I'd call him and say, hey man, I'm playing here or playing there, come on out. He'd come. He'd bring the Nighthawk with him, but he'd come. Sometimes I would invite him down here. He'd come down here. He'd sit right over there on the couch. Sometimes I would invite over some of my Jewish friends, some of my black friends, some of my other white friends, just to engage Mr. Kelly in conversation with somebody other than me. I didn't want him to think that I was some exception. I wanted him to talk to other people. After a while, he began coming down here by himself. No Nighthawk. He trusted me that much, all right? After a couple years, he became Imperial Wizard. He was elevated from state leader to national leader, Imperial Wizard. He began inviting me to his house.
Welcome to this final hour of CNN Sunday Morning. Friendship can transcend all kinds of boundaries.
Just look at us. And two men in Washington area are showing that even an African-American man and a member of the Ku Klux Klan can find common ground. CNN's Carl Rochelle reports.
Davis is one of the few African-Americans you will ever find attending a KKK rally. More than attending, he is welcome.
I got more respect for that black man than I do you white niggers out there.
We get to know one another and we do different things, you know. It hasn't changed my views about the Klan, you know, because my views on the Klan's been pretty much cemented in my mind for years. And I believe in separation of the races. I believe that's in the best interest of all races.
I'm a follower of that man to hell and back, because I believe in what he stands for and he believes in what I stand for. A lot of times we don't agree with everything, but at least he respects me to sit down and listen to me. And I'll respect him to sit down and listen to him.
The strange relationship of a KKK wizard and his black buddy. In Washington, I'm Carl Rochelle.
You have an adversary, an opponent with an opposing point of view. Give that person a platform, regardless of how extreme it may be. And believe me, I've heard some things so extreme at these rallies, they'll cut you to the bone. If you agree with them, great, no problem. If you don't agree with them, that's fine too. You challenge them, but you don't challenge them rudely or violently. You do it politely and intelligently. And when you do things that way, chances are they will reciprocate and give you a platform. So he and I would sit down and listen to one another. Over a period of time, that cement that he talked about that held his ideas together began to get cracks in it. And then it began to crumble. And then it fell apart. And then a few years ago, Roger Kelly quit the Ku Klux Klan. He no longer believes today what he said on that videotape. Okay? And when he quit the Klan, he gave me his robe and hood. This is the robe of the Imperial Wizard. When the three Klan leaders here in Maryland, Robert White, Roger Kelly, and Chester Doles, and I became friends with each one of them. When the three Klan leaders here in Maryland left the Klan and became friends of mine, that ended the Ku Klux Klan in the state of Maryland. Today, there is no more Ku Klux Klan in the state of Maryland. They've tried to revive it every now and then, but it immediately falls apart.
Do you think there's a danger at all that there's some sort of like tacit approval happening? That he can sort of point to you and be like, hey, this black guy, we're cool, so therefore my separatist beliefs are right.
Some of them might feel that way, yeah, sure. I mean, I know where I stand, and I never let it, let it be questioned.
Right.
I mean, they know that I do not approve of separatism or supremacy or whatever. But I have no problem sitting there, shaking their hands. I maintain my beliefs.
Have you ever gotten criticism from black folks or?
Of course, absolutely. Now, black people who are friends of mine, who know me, understand where I'm coming from. Some black people who have not heard me interviewed or who have not read my book, some of them jump to conclusions and prejudge me, just like the Klan. I've been called Uncle Tom. I've been called an Oreo. I had one guy from an NAACP branch chew me up one side and down the other saying, we've worked hard to get 10 steps forward. Here you are sitting down with the enemy having dinner and you're putting us 20 steps back. I pull out my robes and hoods and say, look, this is what I've done to put a dent in racism. I've got robes and hoods hanging in my closet by people who've given up that belief because of my conversations of sitting down to dinner, and they gave it up. How many robes and hoods have you collected? And then they shut up.
Big thanks to Daryl Davis. Now, we'd love a diversity of opinion on the Snap, but I have to ask you a favor. If you see me on stage with the Klan, please, please call the authorities at once. I have been kidnapped and beaten and being held against my will. Thank you. Daryl Davis wrote a book about his experiences called Clandestine Relationships. He spoke with our own Nick Vandercoke. When Snap Judgment returns, we hang out with the highest social class of all, rock stars. Snap Judgment, baby. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR. The unrequited episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and have you ever had a song that you just cannot get out of your head? Well, this week you can blame Snap Judgment Stephanie Fu. You're welcome.
Do, 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 do.
Yeah.
Right?
It was around 1997 that Mark Hawthorne first heard it.
Semi-Charmed Life, and I felt like I was probably too cool for Third Eye Blind. I knew it was like this big popular band, but I heard the song and I was like, okay, fine, I love this song, and I'm just gonna be okay with that.
He bought all their albums, went to all their shows to see their lead singer, Stephen Jenkins, in action.
Yeah, I may have like started building up a fanboy crush or whatever on this guy.
And he could only dream of a bromance between him and Stephen Jenkins until he got a job as the editor of the entertainment section of the San Francisco Onion. And he set up an interview with Stephen Jenkins.
He drove up on his motorcycle, which is pretty perfect because, they have the song Motorcycle Drive-By. I mean, not to get too crazy about it, but there was something sort of like magical when like he like pulls off his helmet and it's like him. I was very excited. I was very nervous.
But the interview went well, super well.
The thing that was so amazing just right off the bat is that he was expressing like how much he loved The Onion, and he would stop every once in a while and apologize to me for not being funny enough.
They talked for 2 hours and they got along so well, Stephen Jenkins invited Mark to come over to his house and listen to the record he was working on.
The whole time I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm like hanging out with Stephen Jenkins. Like this is really happening.
Jenkins kept an email contact with Mark. He invited him to his place to hang out and invited him to a couple of parties.
You know, like I knew that we weren't best friends, but it actually felt real.
Mark started trying really hard to impress Stephen. He'd write positive articles about Third Eye Blind as often as he could for The Onion. And he started to take their relationship a little too seriously.
When I would send an email to Stephen Jenkins and I didn't get a reply in a week, I would be talking to my girlfriend, I would be talking to other friends of mine, just like, look at what the email said. Like, is this bad? Did I write him a bad email?
You're like obsessing, right? Like you're overanalyzing things?
Oh, I overanalyze everything.
Then Mark traveled to South by Southwest to see Third Eye Blind play. And he wrote another review of their performance. But this time, it wasn't just overwhelmingly positive.
And that's where, as far as I remember, is like the first time I finally admitted, like, I love Third Eye Blind, and I know that it's like a super guilty pleasure. I don't know, maybe like a week later or something, he wrote an email to me. He's like, oh yeah, I read your review. And then he points out, I saw you in the crowd. And I was like, oh my God, like maybe he was actually looking out for me.
So it was all good, right?
Soon after, The Onion shut down the San Francisco office. I didn't have a job anymore, but I also didn't have the@theonion.com email address to send to him anymore. Like I probably like wrote to my mom and said, hey mom, I got laid off. Like I'm not gonna be working for a while. And then boom, second email was Stephen Jenkins. Like, hey buddy, you know, like this is the email address you should use for me. And nothing, I got nothing back. And like I maybe sent another email like 2 or 3 weeks later. Oh, it was sad, it was pathetic. And I'm just realizing like, oh my God, like it's all falling apart.
Mark kept going to Third Eye Blind shows, would always try to say hi to Jenkins. He'd wave from the front row, but Jenkins would just look right through him.
And I started thinking like, oh wow, like maybe he was enamored with me because I work for The Onion. And so that's all he ever cared about with me. Like why he would really have cared, like I don't know. Definitely like having this experience with Stephen Jenkins like has made like listening to Third Eye Blind songs like have like different meanings to me. How's it gonna be when you found out there was nothing between you and me? 'Cause I don't care. How's it gonna be?
Mark felt like he lost a beautiful relationship. But I had to wonder, was there really anything to lose in the first place? And we decided to find out.
So you want to describe where we are, Mark?
We are in Stephen Jenkins' studio.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
This is great.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Great shoes, Mark, really.
Oh, thanks.
If you might want to just introduce yourself, that would be awesome.
My name's Stephen Jenkins.
Do you remember why you chose to enter into an acquaintance with Mark? Did you like him?
Yeah, he just seems like somebody who would be part of my friend group. He's clearly very bright, and he's really into music, and he's articulate about it, and he's got a point of view.
That's very nice of you to say.
Yeah.
I'm glad you asked, because I wouldn't want to ask that question. So I guess my first question has to be, like, what did I do wrong?
What did you do wrong?
Yeah. Well, where did things go wrong between us?
Well, I think that they didn't go wrong. I think that we had a successful acquaintance. And I think if one person is measuring an interaction from the standards of an acquaintance, and the other one is measuring it from the standards of a friendship, one in which they know all about you because they've divined so much about you from your lyrics, someone's going to get hurt. In this instance, it was you, Mark.
Okay.
Right?
So, in other words, you're saying I shouldn't take it personally. This is just the way things happen in the world.
Well, what happened, first of all? You say this is the way things happen, so let's try to understand.
Okay.
What happened?
Well, that's what I was trying to understand. What happened? So, I felt like when the Onion shut down the San Francisco office, suddenly I was having to, when I was following up with you, I was having to email you from my home email address. And then that's when everything stopped.
Really?
I never...
What stopped?
I never... You stopped.
I just didn't, I didn't respond.
You didn't respond. And it, and so there was, I mean, I'm not a real stalker.
Has there ever been a stalker who said, I'm a real stalker?
Yeah, I guess so. Okay. I suppose that's a...
So was that twice that you emailed me without a response?
I think it may have been three times.
Three times.
I think there may have been three different
emails. Yeah, I think
emails.
Three times is kind of the rule.
Yeah.
Three times unresponded, then that's not right. Good.
I knew it was over. I recognized that. But then I was like, I'm being really genuine here. I felt like you'd taken it to like this next level of being like a super nice guy. Before I'd ever even met you, like everybody was like, oh, he's this big egotistical jerk. And this could not have been more different. And
no, I'm focusing on like everybody. Like what?
What?
It's okay.
Oh, the egotistical. No, I mean, whatever. Not everybody. Because I obviously didn't know any of your friends. Like these were just things that had been written, what have you. And then when I didn't hear back, I was actually kind of hurt.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I mean, it's water under the bridge.
I certainly didn't mean to hurt your feelings, and I don't know. I really don't, and there certainly wasn't like a conscious choice not to. I think the exchange that goes on between a journalist and an artist is the inverse of what you're talking about. I'll elaborate on that if you want.
Please explain.
Well, I'm still subject to your judgment. It seems to me, if I could just propose this, is you seem to want both. You want to have the idea of being friends, but you also want to assess me and evaluate me as a journalist.
Right. And that was the beginning of how this all started.
Right.
The assessment part.
Right. But I was always being assessed.
Yeah.
Because it's like you never put the pen down. You write about me as being a guilty pleasure. I don't have any friends with whom I'm in guilty pleasure. I'm just a pleasure.
Right.
So you're still judging me. Right? It might be tongue in cheek.
Right.
But that's still what's going on. So I enjoy that, but do the people with really like tight in the braid with me, is that their perception of me? It's not.
Right.
What I'm trying to say wasn't me evaluating and judging you. Actually, I think it was the verse. It's that you were evaluating and judging me.
Can I take from that like any idea of a true friendship ever happening? We were kind of doomed from the beginning.
No. I think it's ongoing. Life is long.
Oh, okay.
I'm enjoying your company right now.
Excellent.
Like this is working for me.
From I feel like we've worked some stuff out. I feel like we've hashed out your feelings.
All right.
If Mark is in the front row of one of your shows now and he's waving at you.
Oh, I'm gonna throw him a pick for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Hey, we're going to play a little show this fall, and we're going to play the Fillmore. That's in San Francisco.
I've been there before.
Yeah, and I'd love to have you. I'd like to put you on the list.
Really?
Just give me your email, man.
I really appreciate that.
There.
No, I just wanted to give him my email address, and so this all worked out at the end.
There it is. Call me.
Thanks so much to Stephen Jenkins and Mark Hawthorne for that piece. Third Eye Blind will be going on tour this winter. So go party with Mark and Stephanie in the very front row. Yes, Snappers, we've reached that time, but don't miss a beat. Full episodes available right now at snapjudgment.org. This show is produced by myself and a team made with love. All kinds of love. Please give some love to the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. He told me the truth. He said one day, Glenn, no woman, no cry. Pat Mussini Miller. Anna Sussman lives in the jungle. Stephanie Fu lives at the club.
Julie DeWitt lives in the cold. Nick Vanderkolk lives for sausages. Renzo Gorio lives with the cool kids. And Will Urbina lives to fight another day. You know that guy that brings a basketball to the tennis court, orders spaghetti at McDonald's, laughs real hard at sad movies? Please don't call the usher. It's just the Corporation for Public Broadcasting trying to mix things up. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. Now, this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could fall in a well. Call your true love with your cell phone. Plead for assistance. Only to have them ask, who are you? And please do not call this number again. Even then, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.